Hi, I'm J. Michael Harrison, and you are in tune to WRTI, a very special edition of The Bridge, a coming together, if you will. Bobby Zanko reached out to me a little ways back and said, hey, it would be cool to maybe get some folks down to the studio, maybe put together a panel and chat a little bit about a series of performances that are coming up, as well as the artists that are the focus of the performances. So, with that said, the Painted Bride Arts Center, along with Ars Nova Workshop, the Warriors of the Wonderful Sound, and the Philadelphia Jazz Project, are very excited to announce three shows in collaboration of paying homage to jazz legends Cecil Taylor, Ornette Coleman, and, of course, Sun Ra. So we have a very special gathering of very diverse artists and journalists hanging out with us, as well as a very small but energetic and enthusiastic audience that has assembled here at WRTI. A good friend and a cat that I've known for a few years now, very talented pianist and Philadelphian for many years now, Mr. Dave Burrell is with us. And Dave, great to have you on the panel tonight.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure and an honor to have you. Jamaluddin Takuma is here with us tonight, and you know, definitely want to hear about his exploits, if you will, with Ornette Coleman, and you know, so it's really a special pleasure to have you here once again, hanging out with me, the very talented bassist Jamaluddin Takuma. Welcome.
My pleasure. As always.
You know, I hesitate using the word critic sometimes because oftentimes there's a negative connotation associated with it. But we'll say journalist, educator, research specialist, if you will, radio air personality at times, and I think is it Grammy award-winning journalist as well. Mr. Francis Davis is here. It's great to have you back with me again.
Good to be here. Writer. Just covers it all.
Yeah, keep it simple. I understand. And my good friend Bobby Zanko, very talented saxophonist who's been in Philadelphia since 1975.
Yeah,
and definitely a major player and contributor to the Philadelphia jazz scene, and always calls me up and reaches out and talks about trying to make something happen, and you know, that's definitely something that I appreciate. But great to have you on board, and really appreciate your efforts.
Well, it's always great to spend some time with you, and tonight especially with so many other great musicians and friends.
You know, I think I want to start our panel discussion, if you will, with maybe just asking you to supply a pat response to something that I throw out, and maybe just your first impressions. A pat response, when I say free jazz, what comes to mind? Free jazz.
Well, I remember when I was very young and I had just started sort of studying and playing in an ensemble that Cecil Taylor had. And he was so nice and so generous. He was writing music every day. And one day, I don't know what happened, but he came in and said, free? It's never been about free. Hmm. So I'll throw a wrench into that.
Okay. Anybody want to add to that?
Well, I remember seeing the album cover of Ornette Coleman laying in front of a record player, and it said, free jazz. And I said, is that what's playing right now? And I said, yeah, and I heard the beautiful bass line of Charlie Hayden. Mm. And then I heard Ornette on top of that kind of just dancing and laughing, you know, in his sound. And I said, oh, that's what they must be talking about.
Two things, at least two things. Playing off something Dave just said, one thing that was striking about that record, at least the physical record, at least the way it was originally issued, was the Jackson Pollock painting, and it seemed to kind of link what was considered the avant-garde in jazz or free jazz with an avant-garde in the other arts. But it's funny when you say free jazz, I always remember a story about after that record came out, Ornette had a gig. I think it was in Cleveland. It was in Cincinnati. You know the one I'm talking about, where Steve Lacy was involved too, and they thought that people saw free jazz advertised and showed up for the concert and got annoyed when they got outraged when they found out they were supposed to pay.
Uh-huh.
So you know it's
fee jazz, not free.
Yeah,
jazz.
And then the other thing is I don't know when you first said it and you asked for a pat answer. You know, you think of it as like a free association test where sometimes your response is like a synonym for the same thing. So it was also called The New Thing, which, mm-hmm. as in the name of the series, or avant-garde. Mm-hmm. Later, people called it, very few people probably called it this, but energy music, free form.
Sure.
You know, all those terms.
Sure.
But I guess free jazz is the one that stuck.
Mm-hmm.
Or free, just free.
Jamal, anything to add to that?
No, it's very interesting hearing all the various takes on that. But my experience being with Ornette is that he, every conversation that we've had, he never considered what he played was free jazz.
Mm-hmm.
He always considered it to be composition or improvising.
And that's true even with, Bobby and I were talking about this on the phone the other day. That's certainly true even with Cecil Taylor. I say even with because I think, especially back in '60s, and I can say for a fact in the '70s, when people first encountered Cecil Taylor, they thought of it as like just primal and made up on the spot and spontaneous and tribal and so on. And you know, no, Cecil is very much a composer. In fact, if I can briefly tell a story about Cecil Taylor that underscores that. He was hanging out in the kitchen at the Village Vanguard one night when Frank Morgan was playing. And I was doing a piece on Frank Morgan. So, you know, it was the first time I think I had really spoken to Cecil Taylor. And he was telling me about a book he was reading and that he really loved, and he couldn't remember the name of the book or the author. So he gave me his number and said to call him the next day. So I called the next day, and the phone rang about four times. And then I thought I got an answering machine because all I heard was piano, identifiably Cecil Taylor, and then the piano music ends and there's a long pause and I'm waiting for a beep and this voice says hello. And I said, oh Cecil, I'm sorry I bothered you when you were practicing. And he said, composing. Making a really, you know, fine but meaningful distinction.
Mm-hmm.
There. The book was Arctic Dreams by Barry mm-hmm. Lopez, as mm-hmm. it turns out. But anyway,
okay.
But I thought that it was significant that he said composing.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
yeah.
You know, I remember reading a piece where Craig Taborn, you know, had said something to the effect that, you know, listening to Cecil is kind of like scrambled Ellington, I think is the way he referred to it. And he said, like, you could take the tone arm and the needle and drop it different places on the Ellington recording. And he said that kind of reminded him of Cecil. For you, Bobby Zanko, for this performance that's coming up at the Painted Bride, if you can talk a little bit about the folks that you've brought together to celebrate Cecil Taylor and maybe what you're trying to accomplish, because you don't hear a lot of people covering Cecil Taylor, per se. So the approach, you know, to this concert to celebrate and recognize Cecil Taylor.
Well, let's see. I could go back to 1969 when I met Cecil, which is a long time ago now. But I'll just go back to the genesis really came from a conversation I had with Homer Jackson, who is the director, I don't know if that's exactly his title, but he's a very important person in the Philadelphia Jazz Project. And we talked about 2 years ago when things were getting together, and he suggested coming up with an idea of something that I might like to do. And he was sort of like, dream big. And I was sort of, you know, I have a lot of, you know, I'm an idea man, so I have a lot of ideas, but nothing came at, you know, I really, it was almost too broad a picture for me to even fill it in. So a lot of time went by, and I guess March came around, and I realized Cecil and Ornette, they're different astrological signs, but they're both born in March. And I realized, you know, that time is really getting on, and how much they both have meant to me. I mean, I met Cecil, I played with Cecil, studied with Cecil, learned from Cecil, you know, since I was, you know, 19 or 20 years old. And then I always listened to Ornette's records from a lot earlier than that. But I got to meet him and study with him, you know, much later. But you know, I was going up for, you know, I learned a lot from him, you know, personally, and he's such a wonderful, both such wonderful people, different. In any case, the Homer said, come up with a project. I realized they both have their birthday. Cecil's going to be 85 this year. Ornette's going to be 84. And I came up with an idea of celebrating their birthdays together, you know, and calling it, you know. So we went back and forth with Homer about a name, you know, and so we came up with this idea, Still the New Thing. And so, you know, the proposal contained a lot of different ideas about how to express that, you know, in terms of musicians, possible groups to play, possible combinations, you know, commissions, different things. And it just sort of evolved very, very slowly and, you know, through a bunch of different phone calls and some personal things that happened to lead me to this ensemble that I have together for the first event, which is like, for me, it's totally a dream. It's like, you know, Henry Grimes. Maybe he's the senior. I don't know. He's a Philadelphian, and I first heard him playing in New York in the 60s, and he was made a number of Cecil's most prominent records on Blue Note, and he's a great musician and a great carrier of the music. William Parker, I've known since he was, you know, since he practically just got out of high school and was struggling on the Lower East Side, we came up together, and I played with William the first time he played with Cecil in a big band concert at Carnegie Hall, which is almost to the day, 73 to almost to the day 40 years from the concert that we're going to be playing that night. It was March of 73. But anyway, so I've known William for a long time, and he's you know, just a major force. He's really carrying this thing along, and he's, you know, does many in many ways. And Andrew Cyril was a I first met Andrew, you know, when he was playing with Cecil in the 60s, and I got to spend a couple of years around Andrew almost every day when I was playing with Cecil's ensemble at Antioch College. You know, a number of musicians had come from all over the country to play with Cecil, where he was in residence. Him, Andrew, and Jimmy Lyons were in residence at Antioch College in the 70s, and we used to, Cecil was, you talk about a composer, he was writing music, he had an ensemble of people that had just come and were sleeping on floors, and it wasn't really students, it was mostly, you know, young people who wanted to learn from Cecil, and he was writing music every day. You know, we would perform a concert every 2 or 3 months of totally new music, long, long, extended pieces. And any case, Andrew was part of that, and he's always been, you know, one of my favorite people, one of my teachers, one of my you know, the people that I admire the most. I mean, he goes back to, you know, just so people know who I'm talking about, this man made a record with Coleman Hawkins when he was 22 years old. He played with Mary Lou Williams. You know, he's quite a you know, he's the history of the music, but what he, you know, and he's does a lot of different things, but the way he played with Cecil for the 10 years he was with Cecil was beyond words. You know, you know, it's nobody plays like that. Mm-hmm. And Dave Burrell is one of my, you know, has always been one of my greatest heroes. Dreamed about playing with Dave. I first saw Dave, he probably doesn't remember, maybe I told him, but I went to a concert at Slug's famous jazz place on the 3rd Street on a Saturday afternoon, and a band with Dewey Redman, Rashid Ali, and Larry Young. Imagine that. These three guys, I mean, incredible. But after they got done after a while, then this guy, you know, this Larry Young playing the doggone organ and Rashid playing loud. And there's this guy playing, young man playing the piano. Do you remember that?
No.
But Dave was playing. Dave sat in, and Frank Wright sat in, and it was very. But in any case, I've listened to Dave for through Archie Shepp, through his own recordings. He used to live across the street from me, and I used to listen to him practice. And maybe most importantly, Cecil always said that Dave was the first one to get it. He said, Dave Burrell, he's the first one to get it. So he should certainly be there. So, and then as far as Ornette, you know, who could I call but Jamal Adeen, who's, you know, the great Jamal Adeen. What can you say? And his son, who's going to lead a band on the 21st. The show on March 21st will be Jamal Adeen's band and DeNardo Coleman's band, you know, which is. When I called DeNardo, he was really excited because he probably, I don't know if he's really led a band. I mean, he was music director for Jane, I guess.
Right.
But this, he was really excited to have his own band, and to have Jamal Adeen go into his Ornette bag is really, really special. If anyone ever saw the Primetime Band, you know how great that is. And then the icing on the cake was... this year is the great Sunrise 100th birthday, and we were able to get the Marshall Allen and Danny Thompson and the orchestra to agree to perform on April the 19th at the Painted Bride, and I'm going to be able to have my big band, you know, which is, you know, in so many ways I'm so indebted to Sun Ra for you know, for ideas, for inspiration, for everything. So I said enough.
Sun Ra would say his so-called 100th birthday.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think it's a fantastic assembling of three incredible concerts, dream concerts, you know, for Philadelphia and beyond. You know, there's so much, you know, I'm trying to squeeze in such a short time with you guys. But, you know, definitely I want to come to Dave real quick about Cecil and maybe coming from Hawaii to Berkeley to New York. And maybe your first impressions of encountering, you know, Cecil and, you know, in that time frame, you know, that's maybe by 65, 66, Sonny's still living in New York. Mm-hmm. He hasn't come to Philadelphia yet, but, you know, just mm-hmm. maybe in encountering some of those cats on the scene and Cecil and Sonny, you know, a couple of guys, you know, sitting at the piano and various other, you know, piano-like instruments, you know, for you. And then I want to come to Jamal and kind of my next word that I wanted a pat response was harmelotics. So we'll work our way over to Jamal in a second. But Dave, if you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, when Sonny Murray left Cecil Taylor, I didn't know that Cecil lived on East 4th Street. I was on East 3rd Street, and Sonny put his new drums in the corner of my third floor walk-up with bathtub in the kitchen. Up until that time, I had been rehearsing with Pharoah Sanders with no gigs, you know. It was just rehearsing with the idea that one day, you know, there might be a gig. Hmm. And once Sonny got there and started playing, and he started to talk about Cecil, and I had heard This Nearly Was Mine, the composition that Cecil played on Candid Records. And I love the way that he had elongated the piece. And he started to talking about compositional improvisation. It's a perfect example because you still heard the thematic material, you still heard the waltz, but you heard all of the nonsense that are part of Cecil's personality. and you got it. You got that it was an illegal, a violation of the standard traditional way of playing the piano, but in our world it was legal and we embraced it. But my first inner thought was, wow, you can do that? And so when I would look over at Sonny, we'd turn off the lights and play from morning till night. And sometimes he had his eyes closed all day. And sometimes, you know, Pharaoh would come in, play with us for a little while, and then you hear him say, I'm going to pick up my kid, or I'm going to go to the store and I'll be back. Okay, and we never stopped playing, but we heard what he said. We might nod. And the point that I'm making was that the dedication was so strong to this music that I was having to learn. And I couldn't be heard at first. When Sonny played the cymbals and he'd play a drum roll, it would snap in the other corners of the room because he had this acoustic sensibility that was like dynamite. So I was struggling for my identity on the keyboard, and I realized that if he was playing low, I had to play high and vice versa. But two summers ago, met Cecil upstate New York in a relaxed situation, and a little bit too muggy, hot afternoon. We were sitting by a pond, you know, and Cecil said, wow, you know, it's kind of like uncomfortable here, but it's beautiful. And I said, yeah, it is. So it's kind of like a lazy afternoon. And he looked at me like, oh, you know about that too? You know? And then, so I hummed it, and I said how I was inspired by it. I said, it's a lazy afternoon. Da-dee-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I said, but you kept going. You went, lazy afternoon. And I said, because that was what was on your maybe subconscious mind. Then finally you got to the dust too. You know, and you kind of put the period on it when you felt like putting the period on it. It wasn't anything that there were no rules that said you had to stop when you stopped. And by the same token, there were no rules that said you had to start when you started. And I said, that in compositional freedom, to take something that's already familiar to the public and keep them with you, it's a gateway to a lot more higher energy playing.
Jamaluddin, you know, I think it was Rick Iannacone I was talking to at one point, and he told me how he struggled for a period of time, you know, and we talk about getting it, understanding the harmonic style of playing. But he said, you know, talking to you, playing with you, working with you, it made sense at one point. He got it. So, you know, when I say harmelodic, mm-hmm. you know, harmelodic style of playing, what thoughts do that conjure up for you?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'd just like to say that just sitting here with these gentlemen, I'm completely being inspired. And Philadelphia is a very special place for music and those who choose to, as Dave said, become illegal in a sense and carry on a certain tradition of being able to express themselves without being, you know, put in a corner. And so, you know, my experience with Ornette is it started off when I was like 18 years old, and, you know, I suppose I had went to, you know, to Paris with him for 2 weeks and wound up staying there for 6 months. And did a series of rehearsing and touring around, staying in one particular area in Paris.
If I can interrupt for a second, mm-hmm. how did that develop? How you know? Well, and had you heard of his music prior to him reaching out?
No, actually not. Actually, I just got out of high school, Thomas A. Edison High School in North Philly, and Sherman Ferguson and Odine Pope suggested that I play with Charles Erlen. So I was on the road with Charles Erlen for like a year. I had got a scholarship to Berkeley, and I chose not to go because I wanted to play, you know, on the road, and I wanted to be a musician touring. And so, which I'm glad I made that choice. And so after being on the road with, you know, and Charles was sort of an organist that was used to playing the bass with his foot or either with his left hand. So, you know, he wanted to try. We're talking like 1974, 75, 76. So he wanted to try to experiment with electric bass, but he still wasn't used to it. So there was moments that, you know, the band would be really hot. And so, you know, as a bass player, I would just go for it. He wasn't used to that because, you know, in those organ trios, they was used to holding a very systematic way of playing. And, you know, everything was extremely, extremely tight. And I commended those guys who knew how to do that, you know, play the organ and play the bass, because that's like, you know, pretty hard to do. And so after one night in Newark, New Jersey, you know, he says, well, you know, I'm going to have to let you go. I was like, what? You know, I didn't go to college, you know. You want me to go? What? So after that, you know, I came home, you know, with electric bass and upright in one hand, electric bass in the other, 18 years old. And I had remember reading something in a Downbeat about Ornette maybe a week before that. And so one week after that, I got a call from Reggie Lucas and James Ntume, who was at the time with Miles. And they were from Philadelphia, but they was, you know, with Miles. And they had found out about me through Sherman and Odine. And so they asked me, you know, would I be interested in coming up to New York to play with Ornette Coleman and rehearse with him. He was going to Europe for, you know, 2 weeks. Would I be interested? So I went to New York and sat in a room with Ornette, placed the music in front of me. And in a non-definite way of counting off, because basically, you know, one, two, three, you know, it was never like one, two, it was like one, two, three, you know. We played, and I played what I, you know, my training, you know, what I thought was correct. And he was gone. And after that, he says, okay, you know. And I knew everything that I did was not correct. But he didn't care. He saw that there was a certain passion that I was trying to reach for something. And in that infantile state, you know, he sort of embraced me and took me on a road with him. And we was there for 6 months. We were supposed to stay for 2 weeks, and we stayed for 6 months. And Ronald Shannon Jackson and myself and Charles Erlen and Charlie Ellaby, the guitarist from Philadelphia, we lived in a loft room, big, huge room in the Rue Monsieur Le Prince, the Le Prince Hotel in Paris. So we had conversations. That was the moment that we had long conversations. You know, we had talks. We rehearsed. And basically, from my understanding with Ornette, it was that, you know, the idea of a person not really knowing anything that has anything to do with anything could come on their instrument and create. You know, I mean, he's often cited the idea of people being in villages that didn't have any idea or any knowledge about musical forms and concepts. They don't know anything about that. They don't know to go to A to C or B to G, and the music that would come up would be incredible, you know. And the music that was being played was for other reasons other than business.
Ceremonies, rituals.
Exactly, things, right. You know, that brought about a certain kind of emotional response or whatever. So, you know, harmonics is basically, in his terminology, is when the harmony, unlike in Western music, where you have all of those various components sitting comfortably in their areas. They're sitting, the harmony is here, the melody is here, and everything is sort of placed in this certain area. And harmonics is when the harmony and the melody and the rhythm is moving in the same direction simultaneously. So that's basically and the melody and the composition being the most important factor of the thing. People always thought that Ornette just got up there and just went, and that was completely far, you know, it was very far from that. The idea of him just playing every, trust me, I know. I mean, you know, we rehearsed one song 50 times, easily. And the idea was that, you know, a guitar player or a bass player or a saxophone player standing in the front of the stage, you know, the idea of, okay, you know, you're going to play for 5 minutes and then, you know, you're going to get the band hot and then, you know, we're going to take off. No, I mean, right from Jump Street. Mm. Because the melody was the most important thing. And all the musical ideas that you had to be equal to the melody. It was more important that we came with musical ideas as opposed to riffs. Because riffs became very boring and they became sort of stale. The musical ideas was the thing that really ignited the composition. So, you know, a lot of times we'd be playing, he'd go, Jamal, you sound like you're laying bricks. I mean, you know, what you plan is not really doing anything that's motivating me or the other guys in the band. So why don't you try to think of more musical ideas that will, you know, become more of a creative statement, you know. So if you play anything less than the melody, then pack your bags and go home. So, you know.
Francis, I'm just looking at you as Jamal is speaking. I don't know if you have anything to chime in on that.
Oh, I thought that was the best definition of harmonics I've ever heard. I mean, I always, you can figure out it stands for harmony motion, movement?
Melodic,
yeah. And Arnett certainly is a melody player. And
Molotics.
Molotics. Harmolotics. Okay, right. I know, yeah, right. Because they got the M-O for motion. But that's the best definition I've ever heard.
People try to make it so deep, you know, but, you know, if Dave could probably attest to this, if you took someone and put them in a room and they didn't really have any, I mean, to be technical is one thing, but to be able to create on your instrument, I mean, if you wanted to wear purple with green or yellow with orange, I mean, who has made the rule? I mean, who has made the definite rule that you can't do that? I mean, if you wanted to play G with C or F to B and create something very musical with that, one should be free to do that, you know, and it has nothing to do with that. So those kind of rules and stuff like that, I mean, I got turned out very early on. So it's hard now for... I mean, and I grew up listening to the Delphonics and you know, the Temptations and all that stuff, and I love all of that stuff as well. And that's the thing that people, they don't get. They go like, well, Jamal Adeen, we know of him being a bass player that plays with, you know, David Murray or Nick Coleman, blah, 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 Hemphill, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, all these really creative people. But then when we sit down in an interview and I say, well, you know, I love the stylistics. What? Mm-hmm. You know, so to me, it's just all the same somehow.
If you just joined in, we are very fortunate to have Mr. Bobby Zank in the studio with us. You just heard Jamal Adeen Takuma. Mr. Francis Davis is here. And Mr. Dave Burrell. And there are a series of performances coming up at the Painted Bride Arts Center celebrating the legacies of Cecil Taylor, Sun Ra, and Mr. Ornette Coleman. And, you know... We could go on forever. I mean, there's so much information that I would like to extract from you guys. But a couple of things. I want to talk a little bit about Sonny in a second. But, you know, also just, Bobby, going back to what you were saying earlier, when I look at these concerts individually, these are like dream performances. I mean, as a fan, when I look at the lineup, and Jamal, if you can let folks know who's going to be with you that night. When I look at these individual lineups, you know how I am, Jamal.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
You know, it's like spider senses are tingling.
Face music.
You know, so when I, you know, saw these lineups, I'm like, are you kidding me? So that night at the Painted Bride on 21st of March, you're going to have...
I'm going to be basically playing music from the record that I did entitled For the Love of Ornette, and which... I was so blessed to have Ornette on that record as well. And for the performance that I'm going to do that evening, I'm going to have one of the gentlemen who performed the record on that record, Wolfgang Puschnick from Austria, who's a very he's a lover of Ornette's music as well.
And you guys have a long relationship.
We have a long relationship as well, you know. And so when we did that record, I think I called Wolfgang on Thursday and said, you know, Wolfie, we're gonna do this record, and Ornette's gonna be on what? Ornette's gonna be on the record. He was like, what? So he says, I said, you got to get here like on Saturday. Pew. I'll see you on Saturday. I'll see you on Saturday.
Okay.
You know, so it was like, you know, it was on that record was Tony Kofi from London as well, and young Justin Faulkner on drums, and Yoichi Uzeki on piano. But on that evening, it's going to be Yoichi on piano, Kyrie Abdul-Shahid on drums from Philadelphia, and Wolfgang is going to come from Austria. And it's going to be pretty. And I have a special guest, but I'm going
to. Okay. So folks have to come out to.
Oh, they definitely got to come out.
To check out the special guest.
And DiNardo's going to be that evening, you know, after, you know, so that's going
right.
to be.
Yeah. And DiNardo.
With his
has,
band.
DiNardo has. He's going to be playing drums, of course. He has Al McDowell. From the Primetime Band.
And then Charlie Ellaby from the Primetime Band, I heard.
And he has Tony Falanga from Ornette's last group. And his special guest, you could say, is the great Antoine Rooney.
Playing
tenor saxophone of the Rooney family.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Francis, you're a Philly homeboy. Mm-hmm. Growing up, Elmwood Avenue, hanging out as a young man.
How do you know Elmwood Avenue? How do you know I grew up near Elmwood Avenue?
I got sources, man.
Okay.
Come on, man. I'm a bad man, Francis.
It was closer to Lindbergh Boulevard, but hey, you know, like, it was between the two.
Coming up, was there a parade when Sun Ra came to Philadelphia? If you could talk about what it was like.
I think very few people realized it. I mean... I guess he moved here, I guess it was like 69 or something. I remember hearing early in 1970, and I was working in a record store at the time, and I called, you know, you couldn't get Sun Ra records that easily, you know, and nobody was used to sending away for records in the mail at the time. And if you sent away for Saturn, God knows what would have happened, frankly, because Sun Ra was not conventional. But so I looked in the phone book, and there listed, I think it was listed under Ra, Sun was a phone number. And I called, and I guess it was Danny Thompson who answered, and he brought me down, you know, the two newest things and a copy that he found of The Magic City, you know, because that was the one I was really looking for. The others were Continuation and Atlantis, I think. But yeah, so that's how I first found out about it. I mean, there were no parades, though, believe me. The first time I heard Sun Ra was at a Coltrane memorial right after Coltrane had died at Irvine Auditorium in 1967. And I believe they had played they played their set at Slugs and then drove here, took a bus, God knows what. I don't mean a commercial bus. Maybe they rented a bus. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah, so they came on around 4 in the morning at Irvine Auditorium. And I remember just being like, you know, just lifted by the music. And leaving after that, even though the concert went on, and having to go to class the next morning too, I was still in school.
Yeah.
You know? But nobody knew Sun Ra was here until gradually, you know, the word got out. Mm-hmm. But I don't think he was playing that many gigs here at that time either.
It's curious, you know, what that transition was like, and it sounds like it was a very subtle transition that.
And it had something to do with, I guess, Marshall Allen owning the property or Marshall Allen's family.
Yeah,
but if you asked Sun Ra, he would tell you it was later. He'd say it was because Philadelphia is the murder capital of the world, or it's the crack capital. They got a crack in the Liberty Bell, or so. He wouldn't give you like a straight answer of why they moved there. It was Morton Street.
Definitely.
So,
Dave, again, you being in New York while he was up there, when did you come to Philadelphia?
85.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, Sonny was still on the scene at that point.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, he used to live across the street from me on East 3rd Street. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing was a mysterious block between 1st Avenue and 2nd Avenue, you know. One day I went over to Sonny's apartment, and again I went with Pharoah Sanders, and we sat on the floor. There was no furniture, but there was music all over the floor and an open kitchenette, and somebody's making a big pot of some kind of stew or something. Smelled real good. And I mean I considered myself a kid, you know, so I was checking everything out, you know. And this whole idea of them already being a family. And I said, what are you guys getting ready to do? And he said, Sonny's going to have 100 pieces in Central Park. And I said, what? And I thought to myself, that's awesome. And I want to be a part of it. So when he came out, I said, Sonny, I heard about 100 pieces in Central Park. Said, yeah. Said, you can be a part of it? I said, yeah, but I play piano. He said, well, you play tambourine and clavier and woodblock, don't you? Said, yeah. So you'd be right there, right next to me. And so I told everybody, you know, hey, you know, I'm going to play with Sun Ra. Said, what, four hands? I said, no, I'm going to play woodblock. And when we got to the park, I mean, everybody squeezed into that shell. And like Francis said, you know, they could do anything. They did things that other groups wouldn't consider doing. I mean, if a bus held 40 people and they had 60 people, it'd be 60 people in the bus. You know, it was not an issue, you know. If whatever was supposed to start didn't start on time, maybe it was 4 hours late, they were still there, you know. If they had to go by boat to Cairo, they went by boat. Mm. I mean, it was that kind of devotion, you know. And so we were all, like, jammed into this shell, and we looked out, and we saw a sea of faces. And every so often, I would go, talk! And I was like, yes!
Did you make any recordings, Dave, as a percussionist for the orchestra?
No, but that was one of my percussion coming out parties.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's special. Bobby Zankel, for you, again, you came to Philly a few years after Sonny came down here. But, you know, again, just connecting with the orchestra and, again, the wonderful performance that's coming up. If you can talk about, you know, just memories of Sonny and the performance.
Well, I'd always heard about Sun Ra in New York because, you know, there was a place, as I had talked to earlier about Slugs, which is also on 3rd Street, different block, but it was on 3rd Street, too. And Sun Ra used to play there every Monday. And I don't know how he got there after, because they wouldn't stop till 4. That would be the most amazing thing. They would play, and it's totally a trance situation. I mean, in 67, everybody was playing. You know, I mean, Stanley Turrentine was playing out. Everybody was playing out. You know, out is the wrong term. There was playing to their physical limits and to their the farthest points of their imagination. And Sun Ra had this orchestra that did it, you know, had been doing it for 30 years already. They started, you know, around 1950 in Chicago, some of them. And so they used to play every Monday in New York, and they would play and they would get done. I never understood how they could just know how to stop at 4 o'clock. I guess I didn't realize for them it was a gig and they wanted to go home probably. But for me, like Dave said, I was a kid and it was just magic. It was so. I remember one time I went home. I was staying with some people out at Stony Brook University and. Out at a house in a country and, you know, something. And going, driving back, getting done at 4 in the morning. Sun is just basically coming up or maybe not come up. And I had him run and get my horn and go out in the guy's backyard. I mean, and do whatever I thought I heard Marshall Allen and John Gilmore do. Right. You know, it was, and I remember, you know, watching the sun come up, thinking I'm getting through where the vibration is it's working. The sun's coming up like that little boy in Black Orpheus, you know. but the what they I mean what they were able to do was just it was certainly beyond like somebody said beyond business. It was really something very, very magical and very, 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 you know, I hate the cliche of spiritual, but it was truly spiritual and opened your mind and I always wanted to do something like that. And then, you know, a few years later, I was in a situation with Cecil and we were playing, you know, we used to rehearse every day. I was talking about in Ohio, we'd rehearse that's what we did. We had come to Ohio for no other purpose than to play with Cecil. And it was a kind of devotion that was really created, you could look at it a lot of different ways, but when I look back at my life, it created a love and gave me an understanding of the power of music, the meaning of music, mm-hmm. the responsibility or the joy or the greatness of how wonderful it is to be able to play music that I know, you know, like Jamal said, he didn't go to music school. You couldn't get in music school. That you know, maybe I'd like to try to share with some of the younger musicians because it's something that's way beyond getting a gig. But you know, so when I came to Philadelphia, I came to take, you know, because my wife at that time got money to go to Penn, and I was taking care of a baby, and I had no feeling to be in Philadelphia. What do you go move from New York to Philadelphia? I mean, now it makes sense, but in 1975, it was you know, like Devil's Island or something. In any case, but I remember, you know, wanting, you know, so much. Wanting to you know, meet up with Sun Ra, and I remember right at that time there was a trumpet player from New York who was working with Sun Ra, Ahmed Abdullah, and he introduced me to Sun Ra. But you know, I remember actually when Cecil came down, we all went to the University of Pennsylvania to the church there, and I ended up. I was sitting next to Sun Ra. I said, "Oh, this is mystical. Somehow, this is meant destiny to happen." So I said, "You know, I used to play with Cecil. You know, and I just moved to Philadelphia." He said, "Give me a number," but he never did call. but it didn't matter. I would have liked to have him call, but. I got so much, you know. We create relationships. You know, we live way beyond our physical bodies. We have minds, we have imaginations, we have, you know, consciousness. So for me, you know, because I know the relationship I have with John Coltrane. I never met John Coltrane, but we commune, and I certainly feel that way It sounds so corny, or it sounds pretentious, but it's very, very, very real. You know, yeah. people love Michael Jordan or something. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, we create our you know, relationships that transcend time and space. And Sun Ra meant a lot to me, and to be able to. It was just up at the studio with you last summer, where Danny Thompson and Marshall Allen and I were all up there at the same time. Mm-hmm. We had such a wonderful time, and we talked about having my big band and his big band perform together, and somehow it's able to happen. You know, yeah. You know, with Sun Ra gone, it's you know, he left something very specific to Marshall, and Marshall is really qualified to carry it on. He's mm-hmm. such a wonderful, remarkable person, and great to be able to do something with him.
So that evening, that celebration of Sun Ra with the Warriors, as well as the orchestra, you know, again shaping up to be something really incredible.
So you know, of course, I feel so honored to be able to play with. On the same, you know, bill as that group.
Friends, it looked like you were trying. You had something that you wanted to.
Oh no, interject. Bobby was just jarring my memory about for the first few years that Sun Ra lived here. How surprising it was! How otherworldly it seemed just to run into Sun Ra on the street, like in a public mm-hmm. place. I was working in a store on Chestnut Street in about 72 or something, and he came in with.
by some members of the orchestra, I don't know. He came in to buy batteries. I thought, like, wow, Sun Ra needs batteries. Well, you know, yeah. And then another time he was I saw him in a parking lot. Somebody was one of the guys was getting the car, and right. Sun Ra was getting into it, and I said hello and all. But you know, it was just, you didn't expect to run into Sun Ra, but not just for the reason that you don't expect to run into celebrities.
Mm-hmm.
Here and there. It wasn't that so much as, like, he had such an otherworldly image, and yeah. I was I guess young and impressionable or something. Sure. But it was like, oh my God, I ran into Sun Ra. Yeah, and then after a while, it was Bobby talking about sitting next to him. That was at a Cecil Taylor concert. You were saying, yeah, I think I even know the one at St. Mary's Church. Yeah, about 74, 75. Yeah, yeah.
No,
I didn't know he was there. Okay, I would have been surprised.
Yeah, all you have to do is look for Sun Ra. Bobby was right next to him. Right. So, as we start to wrap up, and you know, I'm going to ask maybe one more question of you guys, and then we're going to. Provide a segment if anybody in the audience has a question. We'll give them an opportunity or a comment. We'll give them an opportunity. I really don't want to put you guys on the spot, but I'm going to kind of put you on the spot to a certain extent. And maybe just ask you, and you've done this to a certain extent tonight already, but when you think of Cecil and you think of Sonny and you think of Ornette, you know, if there's, you know, maybe a specific anecdote or a moment or something that, you know, you hold on to or something that you share, besides sitting in St. Mary's next to Sun Ra, Bobby, but, you know, some special moment associated with any of the three or all of the three, that maybe you can share with the listening audience.
I'll tell a short one.
Okay.
I know I'm running my mouth. No, everybody,
well, that's why you're here, Bobby.
But, a few years ago, I started. A friend of mine had taken me up to a Christmas party at Ornette's house, so I got to meet him, and he was so gracious. I mean, he said, "You know, if you want to play my horn." But any case, so I started to go up there, and he would teach. I mean, he might explain harmonics a little more complicated than your mom. Mm-hmm,
for sure.
I mean, and wear you out. But one time we were playing, and he was playing, and I was playing, and my eyes were closed. And he said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm playing with Ornette Coleman. And he just looked at me.
No, that's cool. That's cool.
Yeah, talking politics and the need for prison reform in the United States with Cecil Taylor a couple of summers ago.
Was this around the pond, or was this another session?
It was around the pond,
okay.
Up there in Rockland County. And then on several occasions since that time, when I was riding around on the Hudson River, West Side Highway, he would call a friend of mine, and this friend would pass me the phone. I'd say, who is it? Said, it's Cecil Taylor. And say, hi, Cecil. Hi, I hear you guys going to go record now. Say, yeah, that's right. Well, have a good session, you know? And it's like very, very, very inspirational.
Sure, sure. Bright moments.
Yeah.
For sure.
It was a couple of things, well, three things. The first thing is that just the idea of seeing Cecil Taylor on the side of the stage when I was performing with James Carter. And after the concert, he was, you know, I mean, I wasn't sure his reaction to the concert, but it was like, he said something to us like, you guys are like as great as James Brown or something like that. I mean, that, you know. And we sat down and went off to the hotel, you know, the hotel lobby and just sat out there for hours talking after the concert, you know, James Carter, myself, and Cecil Taylor. My other feeling was just the idea of Ornette being such a mentor and someone that just set me free, you know, just allow me just to just, you know, play what I wanted to play, and that kind of set me up for all the things that I needed to do in my career later on.
And also, I remember you sharing with me a story one time how you had stepped away from music.
Yeah. I had embraced Islam, and I was sort of on a spiritual journey, and which was good as well. And I was a young father, and I wanted to make sure that I had time for my wife, and I wanted to make sure that I was raising my children, and I knew all of the consequences and the pitfalls of the music business itself, and I didn't want to deal with that. And so I kind of left music alone for like 1 year, and Ornette came to Philadelphia, and gave my mother like, you know, $100. And say, you know, talk some sense to this boy, you know. And so after that, I played with him, and we did a concert at Carnegie Hall, and that just started me back up again. Mm. So yeah, that was something when I think about it. I forgot about that actually until you mentioned it. But it was always all kinds of things like that, you know, with him that just kept me in motivation. And the other thing was the recording that was supposed to have happened with Cecil and Ornette, which we did the rehearsals for.
Mm.
That didn't happen.
Mm.
And so, you know, that was a quiet moment in history, but that almost happened, and it didn't happen. But I remember the rehearsal quite well. Yeah.
Francis, you have a look.
Are you free to explain why it didn't happen? Because everybody's always wondered about that.
Yeah,
No,
I don't know.
Well, I know they each have their own point of view. Cecil actually went, because there's a tape of it now. There's mm-hmm. a tape of the first time they got together.
Mm-hmm.
And Cecil actually, Ornette gave him triads. And he, you know, and Ornette, Cecil actually tried to learn the triad. Not tried to learn, he learned what Ornette had shown him. And then when he came back, he started playing them. And then he, Cecil said, too busy with the left hand.
Well, Ornette said to Cecil? That
yeah.
Said, oh, okay, yeah, right, yeah. Okay.
That was the end of the project.
I'm not getting in it. I have okay. no idea.
And Ornette told me he was frustrated when they wanted to rehearse, and Cecil wanted to rehearse on one of the pianos that cost thousands of dollars.
The Bösendorf.
For a rehearsal.
You guys know more than I.
Who was the drummer? Who else was
I think it was probably it might have been DiNardo, it might have mm-hmm. been Ronald, you know, I can't remember
mm-hmm.
exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's yeah.
But before we move to Francis, Jamal, with Sun Ra, you know, it seems like you'd have been a natural to spend some time.
Well, I had my little mm-hmm. experience with him, but it had nothing to do with it had to do with music, but it was more or less I was coming from rehearsing with Ornette on an Amtrak train on the way to Philadelphia. I'm sitting here, and, you know, like towards the end of the train, you know, there's a seat, you know, the two seats, and then there's one more seat behind, and then there's the door.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked back, and it was Sun Ra. He's back there. And he had his hat on, you know, the whole thing.
Beautiful.
And he talked my ears off from New York to Philadelphia. And I remember that clearly because I was, you know, just, you know, and he was just talking and talking and talking. It was wonderful.
That's beautiful.
So that was my only experience.
Okay. Francis.
Well, I already told, you know, my Cecil Taylor anecdote.
Right.
But there's something, this didn't happen to me, but it's something somebody told me. There was, I don't know where he is now, there was a writer in New York named Lee Jeske. Who one afternoon in New York, he went to Times Square, I guess it was, to see Rocky V, I guess, when it came out. And the lights came on afterwards, and there were a few rows in front of him was Sun Ra. So he went up to him and introduced himself and said, why are you here to see this movie? And Sun Ra said, it was advertised. God knows what, I don't know if he was being neither did Lee, if he was being cynical or he thought that there was something in the ad The only other thing I'll say, when I finally went out to the Sun Ra house to do a piece on Sun Ra for the Philadelphia Inquirer, I went with the photographer who had been assigned, and he was a young guy, and he said he was very eager to do this because he wanted to see what Sun Ra was like out of persona. And I thought, yeah, man, you're in for a surprise. It's no persona. This is what he is. And if you listen to the tape, about 15 minutes in, after I asked one question, and Sun Ra's still talking, I have to interrupt them, and I didn't know how to call him Sonny. I think I called him Mr. Raw. So, I said, Mr. Raw, I think Ron wants you to move a little bit over there. That was the photographer, so that he can get that shot under the sculpture there. And I remember, you know, when I listened to that tape, I remember Ron, the photographer, was there just with his mouth open, gazing, because there is no persona with Son Ron. One of the first things he said was, I asked him how he started playing piano, and he said it was a gift from my mother and my aunt for my so-called birthday. That's why I said earlier,
sure.
So-called.
Right.
Nothing. Mm-hmm. Every sentence was in total, you know, totally synchronized with that image he projected. There was no stage presence and offstage presence.
What you
he
see is what you
guy.
Get. Yeah.
That was it, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful. Before we move to our audience, I want to take a second and thank you guys. It's great to have you come down and share a little bit. Bobby, again, the three performances coming up at the Painted Bride, coming up on the 8th?
March 8th, celebrating Cecil. March 21st. Celebrating Ornette, and April 19th, celebrating Sun Ra.
Outstanding. All right, we're going to field a couple of questions from our audience, and we're going to pause briefly and come back and hear from the audience. So we are very fortunate tonight to have a studio audience for this panel discussion, and we wanted to provide a little time towards the end to field a few questions. So if you would introduce yourself and maybe present the question or questions that you have.
Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm Vic Shermer. I write reviews and do interviews for the All About Jazz website, and Bobby invited me to come tonight. I just love the discussion. I felt like I was there when these things were happening. These stories are so evocative, and the aliveness of this music, and the stories are part of the music in some way. That's the feeling you get. My question is, during the period of time that Cecil and Ornette came up, there were so many new developments in jazz, you know, just, you know, everything from bebop to hard bop to Brazilian to Miles Davis to Gil Evans to Dave Brubeck, Charlie Mingus. The music just exploded in that period of time in the late 50s and the early 60s. And yet, you could only apply the title Still the New Thing to Cecil and Ornette. You couldn't say quite that phrase for some of the others. And my question is why?
Oh, I think that you were having the so-called inside jazz versus the outside jazz. And if you look at it that way, you see Ornette and Cecil being on the outside. They were not really in New York City getting the kind of airplay that would be considered mainstream airplay, because they were not mainstream. Whereas, say, with Bossa Nova, it fit right directly into the mainstream.
I think, you know, just to be, this is oversimplification, but they both did a particular thing in music, which is hard to define, but I'll try Cecil. The thing, I mean, he did a lot of things, but the thing that he did that nobody did before him was to have play jazz, play black music without a regular meter. It wasn't 5/4, it wasn't 7/4, it was non-metric. And that was a tremendous breakthrough and a tremendous challenge to everybody else who played, and a tremendous, almost an insult to some of the older guys. And to this day, some people still hate him for it. But almost everybody, if you go to see the most bland, average guy, there's going to be a point in the evening when they all play without any meter. And that idea stuck. What to simplify Ornette's contribution is that what he did was have a group improvising continuously, you know, meter or not meter, but having them improvise without a regular set of chord changes. They would create, I mean, they were playing harmonic music. They're playing music that's governed by, you know, the laws of tonality, but they're spontaneously creating their own form and creating their own resolutions and based, as like Jamal said, on ideas rather than a set structure. And that's, everybody does that now.
Yeah, there are many ways to answer that question, and many possible answers. But I just wanted to say, at the time, I remember, I never liked the term the new thing. There seemed to be something facetious about it. There seemed to be something like, oh, this is the fad now. Next year we'll all be playing, you know, Brazilian or something, but this year we got to go, you know, we have to play the new thing. And it's why avant-garde was fine with me in a way, and why Cecil Taylor and Ornette are still considered, you know, to be part of that. And say, like, somebody, like, I think the best example would be Mingus, why he's not usually talked about that way. It has a lot to do with when they made the recording debuts. It has a lot to do with the people who, not the circles that they joined so much as the circles that formed around them. And in many ways, I mean, I think Jamal Dean was touching on this earlier when he said that Ornette never he said something about Ornette.
He never considered.
He just, yeah.
You know, the title itself, Free Jazz, he never really
right.
Never
that's
really
right.
Liked
the Free Jazz thing. I mean, in many ways, what Cecil's doing, what Ornette was doing, what Mingus was doing, and so on, it's American composition. Now, it was considered black music too, and the period was very politically charged. But in some ways, it has a lot in common with, say, Stockhausen. Or somebody like that. I mean, it isn't to say it sounds like Stockhausen or John Cage, but it's composition. It's music, and I never liked the new thing. That's what I think started this ramble of mine just now. I never liked that. There just seemed to be something like, oh yeah, we'll play the new thing. Mm. You know, all the guys are going outside. This, you know, that wasn't the way I think Ornette or Cecil or any of those people thought.
Okay.
For me, I think that I think it was more the aesthetic. I think that, you know, Cecil, when, you know, with the whole concept of bringing together the music along with dance, you know, the concept with Ornette was bringing the music along with visual aesthetic. If there was something, because like Bobby said, that, you know, they were pretty much hating on those guys. I mean, I didn't live in that period. I don't know exactly what was going on. And after I heard what some other musicians had did to Ornette, and I would look at Ornette, and he never was angry about it. You know, he never showed any anger about it. You know, it was always about love and the music. But I can't imagine somebody coming up on stage and punching him. Or, you know, I mean, and that's just what we know. I mean, it was like all kind of stuff that was happening. And maybe Dave probably, you know, probably knows more in detail, you know, from, you know, being, you know, a little older than myself, knowing
the
what
controversy
was going on.
And,
yeah, you know. But again, it's, you know, it was, and I also think it's generational, because I think right now, kids, they're listening to music that, which is including textures. You know, it's not really, it's more like, they can put a CD or a record on and hear multiple textures in music where, you know, they've become very, you know, accustomed to the sound. whereas before they weren't. And so, you know, I think it's a continuation of with Cecil and Ornette, what they were doing then, and how it sort of, you know, prepared people for what they're listening to and how they're hearing things now. You know, I mean, there was one time also where the record company, my original record company, Grammarvision Records, didn't know where to place me inside. You know, I mean, you know, Ornette and they had a major label at the time. Now, the 80s, when I started doing my stuff, things became a little bit more independent. You know, there was no really huge machines behind, you know, there was kind of an independent kind of, you know, vibration happening. But when Ornette was doing anything with Atlantic Records, there was kind of still that machine that was behind them. So they chose. I mean, and then the music business, I keep going back to that, you know, and it's, you know, they pick and choose who they want, you know, to do whatever, you know. And I'm sure that was, you know. A factor, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, you had one guy who was probably doing, I'm sure, maybe the same thing as any of those brothers, you know. But it's like, you know, pick him. I mean, it's the same goes on now. So, but the only difference now is that being independent, you can do your own recording. You don't have to wait for anything. You can do your own recording. You can actually pay yourself, and so, you know. I think it was a preparation. I think what they've done then sort of allowed, you know, people now to be more receptive to, you know, what they hear. So,
okay. All right. So we have another question coming from the audience.
I think a question and maybe a comment.
All right.
Hi, my name is Homer Jackson from the Philadelphia Jazz Project, and I want to start off by talking. I'm speaking now as a visual artist. And so hearing these guys talk about their history and their relationship to these masters made me misty-eyed because I'm hearing my DNA as a visual artist coming through the work of Cecil Taylor, coming through work of Ornette Coleman, the whole idea of Ornette and Cecil being connected to the visual art community in New York. Mm-hmm. During the 50s, and the relationship between the poets, the writers, the musicians, and the visual artists in New York, and how much of an impact those folks had on the rest of us years later is just so interesting to hear that. I mean, I met Bobby when I was in either undergraduate school or graduate school, and we've known each other for a long time, and I've always respected his work. I met him through my mentor, John Dowell, who was a visual artist who wanted to create scores for music, much like Cecil or Anthony Braxton would do back in those days. And it's just fascinating. I'm getting older and teary-eyed about the idea of looking back at where we come from to where we are today and how those two gentlemen have had a major impact on the way I think and create, even though I never necessarily met them. But the freedom that they created, the choices that they made, gave us, just like Jamaluddin said, you know, he demonstrated an approach that did not necessarily exist for other folks. And he took the risk. And one of the things, I guess this is one of the things we could talk about that I can ask the question is, that particularly with Cecil Taylor, there's a significant Philadelphia relationship with Cecil Taylor. And I just keep thinking about, as Jamal talked about Ornette maybe getting punched in the face, that you were not messing with Cecil Taylor when Sonny Murray or Archie Shepp were on the stage. Mm. You were not messing with them dudes. You know what I mean? He also had Bill Barron. He had Ted Kersen. He had Henry Grimes. You know, it's just really interesting that this Philadelphia relationship and then the history of the other community that was connected to John Coltrane in the 50s here in Philadelphia, Hassan, Bill Barron, and so on, that we have branches of that community, the avant-garde, that, as you said, they weren't necessarily connected to the industry, but there were folks out there making things happen in our community that we should celebrate. And part of the reason why I love this idea from Bobby is because this whole thing points the light back to us as a community and says, like, not only can we celebrate these folks, but we can look at ourselves and look at our relationship to these folks. So I was really excited about this idea when he first mm-hmm. brought it. And I was like, yeah, let's go.
Let it be known that there's a painting that Homer made of Cecil that sits on Cecil's wall.
I didn't even know that. That's true.
So
it's true.
Wow.
Yet another anecdote.
Wow.
All right. So unless you guys have something else, I think we're going to bring this session to a close. Thank you. So again, Dave Burrell, Bobby Zankel, Mr. Francis Davis, Mr. Jamal Dean Takuma, great to have you guys come down and share a little bit with the listening audience. Looking forward with significant excitement to these three performances coming up. Still the New Thing Festival taking place at the Painted Bride Arts Center. Also, you know, thanks once again to Ars Nova Workshop for, you know, playing a role. Thanks again for the Philadelphia Jazz Project. And playing a role, and of course, the host location, the Painted Bride Arts Center.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you.